Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation.
Books. Where would we be without books? Where would we be without Gutenberg? It's a rhetorical question, sir. But where would we be without books?
From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Michael Silverblatt, and this is Bookworm. Today, I'm really excited because my guest is one of the wittiest writers in the world. It's Wayne Kestenbaum. His most recent book is an essay-length book, or a book-length essay, called Humiliation. It's published in paperback by Picador. It has an ideal cover. Would you describe it, Wayne?
Thank you for calling it ideal. It's a diary whose lock is in the process of having been picked, so that there are slash marks on the leatherette surrounding the lock. So the diary, it has already been picked, but it's been reclasped, but it looks like a violated body.
If you knew how many novels in which the revelation is that the diary is not in its right place, and this means that someone, usually mom or dad, has read it. But if there's anything worse, it's someone knowing your inner thoughts and you're being humiliated by someone's power over you because now they know your secrets. I assume you chose this subject.
I did. I presented it to the publisher. With a list of other subjects, including repetition, pleasure, probably boredom, you know, maybe, so the publisher was most excited by Humiliation.
And they have published it in a rather remarkable series. It's called Big Ideas, Little Books. Mm-hmm. What are the others in this series?
The series was launched with Slavoj Žižek's Violence. I think I'm saying his name correctly. And the series also includes Susie Orbodies and Jenny Diski's The 1960s. These are small, opinionated, discursive, somewhat high-minded or highbrow, but accessible accounts of a certain cultural complexity.
And listeners who've been following know Wayne. He's been on twice before. I think of great significance on the Robert Walser show, a tribute to the great author. He read a list of qualities of Walser's writing, and the list is one of your forms. Why do you like it so?
It tranquilizes me. The act of preparing a list or setting out to write in the form of a list, it performs on me a kind of inner mental hygiene that I don't think in terms of linear arguments exactly, but I do think in terms of like bodies, and I like to stack phrases and ideas next to each other's phrases that resemble each other, so that literally when I set out to write a paragraph, say, and I start the list making apparatus in me starts to rev up, I know exactly where I'm going, and I can also relish the incongruities between the different members of the list. It allows me to be both thorough and inconsequential at the same time.
Would you say that the list is a homosexual form?
Oh, I'd love to say that anything is a homosexual form.
I'm thinking in particular of Cole Porter being famous for his list songs. They're patter songs, and they list You're the Top, and it, you know, contains a whole list, you know, a Berlin ballad, a Waldorf salad, you know. It's sort of a discrimination in a way, and it's making all sorts of refined notes about small differences.
Well, I would say that I love that point. It's a remarkable subtlety and outre-ness. I would say that the list has a certain gay vibe, or has his in the last couple of centuries, maybe because it evades the march of a certain kind of doctrinaire thinking and progress. It allows one to assemble private collections of, I'm thinking of, in a way, say, Shonagon's pillow book. We wouldn't say she's gay exactly, but she is a connoisseur of like things, and she stacks together things that irritate her, things that pleased her. It's a way of, the list is a way of organizing the world according to the dictates of personal idiosyncratic taste.
Well, that great Japanese diarist, Sei Shonagon, is writing at a time where ritual and extreme delicacy, you know, in a certain way, different societies prize these things at different levels, and perhaps in our time, gay culture is the prizer of the specificity of how to do things.
Well, certainly, we're thinking of the opening of James McCourt's Mardu Gorgeous, which famously begins with the list, which is simply a list of the dramatis personae, but it's also a reference to the list of those allowed to go backstage at the Metropolitan Opera to talk to the diva afterwards. And I mean, I think also to take it.
You're so right.
Yeah, no, it's
that phrase.
The
did
list.
Did he make the list?
Yeah, the list. Did he? But I also think that the list, to take it out of a particularly sexual underground category, has the arts of appreciation even of the natural world. I'm thinking of Dorothy Wordsworth and Thoreau, among others, of a certain kind of diary keeping and or bookkeeping intelligence that rather than assembles a raison d'etre for everything, simply pays attention to it when it occurs. And that's one could call that a kind of Zen mode, or it's a mode maybe that we associate with a figure in America like John Cage, who was all for noting what really is rather than marshaling what is into some larger structure.
It's interesting because in this book, Humiliation, by my guest Wayne Kestenbaum, it's a list not of perfect things, but of humiliations. And, well, Wayne, how tragic that you have lists of such things. Most of us remember humiliation as a singular, dreaded past event, but you have them in this book the way a dog has fleas.
Well, I assembled them, so I don't have them. I also have perhaps just an aura or cloud around me of unhappy memory, the way we all do about humiliation. But the process of writing the book was laying out on the table the various specimens and putting them into a kind of nifty order, and that I want to emphasize that the act of laying them out and stacking or accreting them offers a kind of surplus pleasure that takes away the sting of the original occurrence and gives a bit of the collector's pleasure. I won't say that it's like a stamp collection or even a butterfly collection, but that the making of the list has a tonic and tranquilizing effect.
So that just by collecting them, they are made a part of a sampling, and therefore you take away the sting.
Also, there is silence between each member of the list, so that in the last chapter, Eavesdropping on Humiliation, where I list 70 bad things that happened to me and other people I know, there's a lot of silence in that chapter. There's like five of these little fragments per page. But the space between them, like the spaces between haiku or stanzas, require of the reader certain kinds of mental leaps and processes that are restful and silent and not malign.
I'm speaking to Wayne Kestenbaum. His book is Humiliation, and it's a book about this, well, simultaneously minor and major subject. Humiliation is an irritant that in the mind retrospectively becomes enormous.
Mm-hmm.
What's the style that accommodates that subject? What did you find?
I love that you ask about style, because the subject is dirty in a way, or morbid. It involves lynching photographs and the Holocaust and dead bodies and emissions and shames. But the style of quick visits, the style of rapid movement through the different stations of the cross, afforded me a kind of whirlwind pleasure. But the style I chose was, I think, somewhat straightforward, not too full of elaboration or historical detail, somewhat funny, laconic. I was also wishing to go to the bottom of my emotions, which I rarely, I think, have tried to do in a book before. I usually like to stay, to weave in and out of the surface and glimpse the depths, but not go. And I would really take time between sentences sometimes and stare into the subject, however dreadful, and think, what honestly occurs to me right now? Like, for example, in the chapter where I talk about the lynching photograph, something I didn't even really want to talk about, but I felt the call to do so by the subjects, letting there be even a moment of silence within the writing for me to say, and now, in parentheses, I am looking away from the photographs, unable to speak, to even include that kind of hesitation.
You know, it wasn't known until fairly recently, but there were photographs taken at lynchings down south, and horrifyingly, mm-hmm. families would pose next to the hung and mutilated bodies of men and even women who'd been lynched, mm-hmm. hanging from a tree. Now, in what sense does this enter the realm of humiliation rather than cataclysm or, you know, the death of morals? It seemed to me that when we entered that part of the book where you were talking about lynching and Holocaust, we had gone beyond humiliation to something programmatic mm-hmm. and tragic.
Mm-hmm. That is true. I would say that, though, for me, to take the example of lynching, part of the theatrical spectacle of lynching, I mean, yes, it was systematic racism, and there were social inequities that were larger than a mere affect at work there. But I think that the notion of standing by while somebody else suffered involves the classic paradigm of humiliation where there is a victim, a witness, and a tyrant. I'm also aware, for me in writing, I tend to like to stretch a category. I like to find the outliers, and I like to include, to not go toward the ordinary specimens, but to find, like, for example, that I talk about the art of Basquiat, which doesn't really have to do with humiliation, except I felt a yearning to talk about some art, and I felt that Basquiat's use of block lettering and actually of crossed out phrases in his art viscerally felt to me like emotions that were humiliating, even though the art, because it's great painting, is really about triumph and vindication, not about humiliation. I like to stretch my categories.
The mere fact that these photographs exist mm-hmm. humiliates an entire culture.
Yeah,
I mean, suddenly the victim here is no longer the innocent person who's been attacked and mutilated. Mm-hmm. It's the people who think they have something to be proud enough of mm-hmm. that they'd be photographed mm-hmm. having done it, standing there as if with pride, swelling with pride to memorialize this occasion. That enters the realm of what you call aesthetic shock tactics.
I also think that what we call national face or national pride or even international relations has a lot to do with the self-images of nations. And that, for example, that Germany's humiliation at the end of World War I perhaps abetted the rise of Hitler. This particular state of the American image now, post Abu Ghraib, nations have a standing, and that humiliation is a useful term to apply to the way nations see each other, which includes, I think, rival factions within one nation.
So the method really is to go from the trivial.
Yes.
They saw me after I sneezed with snot hanging out of my nose, mm-hmm. to the huge, the tragic. America needs to humiliate its victims,
yeah.
more even than to track them down and punish them. We need to be seen as a global humiliator.
And also, I mean, in terms of just to take the sneezing and getting snot on my hands, which is just one of the little stories I tell at the end of the last, in the last chapter, I wouldn't have been drawn to write about the larger questions of social injustice and shame if I didn't have within me very, very clear memories of private shame that to me really aren't trivial but are my entryway into the larger theme. I'm essentially an autobiographical writer, and like my great models, Michel Léris and Marcel Proust, and also while we're at it, André Gide and Jean Genet, who are really the four writers who have meant in some ways the most to me as models, I believe that by looking within and by hugging and mining certain memories again and again and dilating them, anything can be found. And it's also the Montaigne style of writing an essay. It's that you keep delving into a subject, even if it's just sneezing in third grade and I got snot on my hand, but don't let go of that incident until it can mean everything.
I'm talking with Wayne Kestenbaum, the author most recently of Humiliation. I'm Michael Silverblatt, and you're listening to Bookworm from the studios of KCRW. We'll continue after this short break.
I'm Connie Alvarez, producer of Bookworm. Check out our other KCRW programs in the podcast section of iTunes. Shows like DNA, Good Food, The Treatment, Unfictional, and The Business. Or listen on KCRW's smartphone apps. And thanks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. This is Bookworm. By the way, listeners, if you haven't joined KCRW's Bookworm Book Club on Facebook, this is the perfect time to do it. We're voting to select the next book to read. Join Book Club members from around the world so your vote will count. Just go to kcrw.com/bookworm for instructions on how to join. I'm speaking today with Wayne Kestenbaum about Humiliation, his new book. Well, what can I say? Everyone begins life in a humiliating position. And one of the things that Gulliver, of Gulliver's Travels, found when he was tied up and among those giant people that when he looked at them, their pores of their skin, blown up so enormously, were gross. Life, when looked at closely, is a vast set of opportunities for humiliation.
I'm thinking suddenly, exactly, when you talked about the pores up close, I'm thinking of the great photographs by the art critic John Copland, I don't know how he would pronounce the name, at 60 years old or something, this noted art critic started taking pictures of his not pretty, aged, hairy, slack, nude body. They are glorious. What's glorious about them is that, of course, he has in some way humiliated or at least embarrassed himself by showing his nude and conventionally unattractive body in these close-ups that even if you were to just see the whole John nude, he would look okay, but nobody would look good in these close-ups. But they're weirdly beautiful, and I think they show this kind of John Cage-like point that if you pay close attention to something, sure, you see that the pores are big and ugly, but you can also begin to see a kind of extraterrestrial beauty.
Yes. Now, can you begin to describe the beauty of the horrible? How does one get at it?
Well, I mean, I talk about the poetry, we could call it that, of Artaud.
Artaud was one of the most beautiful French actors of his time. He was also a poet and playwright. And as he began not only to go crazy, but to cultivate insanity, his work became demonic, depraved, uglier, and he was the inventor of the theater of cruelty.
And he wrote poems where he described himself essentially being raped from within by demons and succubi. It's filthy. It's self-flagellating, but it's also completely sublime. And what for me are the touchstones of humiliated art, in a way, are these drawings that he took a lit match to and had there are actually holes in the paper. And when I saw those at the Museum of Modern Art years ago, some part of my aesthetic journey began right there when I saw the holes gouged in anger and self-loathing into his own portraits, really. And I thought, right, when I write, I am also making holes in the page. There are sentences and words, but I am gouging myself when I compose. Writing hurts. And it's that insight, I think, of the, call it the auto-humiliation of the act of writing that is at the root of this essay.
And it's always those unnameable things, those sounds that you can't say, that your bowels are making, that you hope no one is hearing, those odors that are emanating during the very private moments when you're naked between two people already. These are the moments of humiliation, and most of the time they make for comedy. We're okay in the movie theater watching people fart in their wedding gowns.
Yeah.
That's funny. But what about when we've become so self-conscious, so self-aware, that we can't see it as funny? These are the moments that Wayne Kestenbaum is best about.
Well, I do a funny trick in my books, and in this book in particular, is where I take things that maybe most people wouldn't even want to say in public, and I say them, and I say them with a certain bold frontality, sometimes laconically, with a dignity and reticence, but sometimes flamboyantly. And for me, it's all about the tone with which I spin it, not about anything intrinsic to the subject.
I think that often as not, because you've chosen icons, opera divas, Jackie O, the subject as a whole of cleavage, the spaces that are secret, hotel rooms, places where people go to have secret assignations, that your job as a writer, you've taken it to be the classified revealer, the secret teller, mm-hmm. the whistleblower, and even the official pointer at.
Yes. In fact, this book, my duty, and I say it very clearly, was to express affinity with those who are publicly shamed for having what I call complicated erotic agendas. And I think that what drove me to write this book was really my horror during, did they call it Monica Gate, when the whole country was really humiliated, but certainly Bill Clinton and his family was, by pretty ordinary sexual misconduct being raised to the level of a crisis of state. And then I also felt, I think, when Michael Jackson was accused of sleeping with 13-year-olds and whatever happened there, who knows, but that the notion that suddenly everyone knew about Michael Jackson's pornography collection, I thought, why isn't anybody standing up for Michael Jackson at this moment and saying there's something really awful that happens when an entire culture can stand and point the finger at a man or a woman who is considered mockable and despicable because of something that person did with his or her body?
Oh, Wayne, well, you see, this is the subject constantly verges on either the heartbreaking or sometimes the hilarious, but it asks a question: what is it that can stand too much scrutiny? When we have, via the web, a virtual countrywide audience of scrutinizers, all of them saying, I don't believe she chose that dress. I don't believe that corsage is real. I can't understand how she could wear those fake contact lenses. Suddenly, we have a nation of people who are acting as aestheticians, mm-hmm. but who haven't been trained.
I agree. For me, the moral of the book, or of my life perhaps, is become an artist. Whatever your art form is, choose some way to house, contain, and transform the lurid experience so you can make it your own and turn it into your artifact. If Monica Lewinsky, for example, had not been the victim of everybody's cruel scrutiny, but had made of her dress or even made of her public speech her own act, if she had signed it in some way, it would have been different. Of course, this is not always possible. Even the great Oscar Wilde, who could sign anything, even before Duchamp signed a urinal, Wilde was doing that, could not turn his own trial into a work of art. And that it's Oscar Wilde's trial that is also really at the bottom of this book, where somebody who was very good at turning awful things into beauty finally met the limit of reality and social terrorism. And though he tried to turn his trial, where he was arrested for what they called sodomy, he tried to turn it into a sonnet or an artwork, but it ended up just 2 years of hard labor in prison. And you asked about aesthetics versus physical pain, or you were implying that. And for me, the difference between thinking about humiliation or writing about it or aestheticizing it and certain kinds of suffering is the presence of unavoidable physical pain. When Oscar Wilde was in prison doing hard labor, he did not have the luxury of seeing it, his suffering, as an artifact. Though he then did write in his letter De Profundis to his boyfriend Bosie Douglas about how humiliation had ennobled him. So it's even in prison, I think, even on Golgotha, there are ways to frame one's suffering and turn it into a kind of transfiguration.
It's a good way to end. We are transfigured, if we can be, by our small, horrible acts becoming treasured. I think that sometimes is what they call love.
That's a beautiful, it feels like a moment in a Verdi duet, just where love and the key changed. I just felt that it went to major from minor.
I've been speaking with Wayne Kestenbaum, author most recently of Humiliation, published by Picador. It's a book in which he proves that anything, however ugly, can become aestheticized. Thank you, Wayne, for joining me.
Thank you, Michael.
You can comment on today's show at kcrw.com/bookworm. Download the podcast from kcrw.com or from iTunes. You can also listen on demand with KCRW's smartphone apps. Alan Howard is associate producer. The technical director is Mario Diaz. Special thanks to Craigor Thine. I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm.
I am a bookworm, he is a bookworm, she is a bookworm, we are all bookworms. I am a bookworm, we are all bookworms.
Funds for Bookworm are provided in part by Lannan Foundation. This program is produced in the studios of KCRW Santa Monica. You can access archives of all Bookworm programs and podcasts, the most recent ones, at kcrw.com/bookworm. The Bookworm themes were composed and performed by Ron and Russell Mayle of Sparks.
I'm Michael Silverblatt. Join me again next time on Bookworm when Ayad Akhtar is our guest.
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
I want to tell you about a new show from the Financial Times called Life and Art from FT Weekend, hosted by me, Lila Reptopoulos. Life and Art is twice a week. On Mondays, I have a guest on to talk about life and how to live a good one. Everything from winter travel to cooking to living more creatively. And on Fridays, we talk art. Two FT journalists and I discuss a piece of culture that's in the air. New music, movies, and more. Find Life and Art from FT Weekend wherever you listen.